Oh, there I am. Oh, and welcome back again. You guys were looking at me like, how? Where did Dave go? He was talking. No one heard me. And, of course, you're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. And, again, thank you to Leah Haben, founder of SmartFem, John Branson, director of marketing for Solis, as well as Trace Lillard is the director of sales. They were awesome. And, of course, John was a former Arizona Cardinal. Boy, he looks like a strong football player, and I offered to arm wrestle him. I won't tell you who won. So, anyway, it is now Understanding Autism every second Monday and Tuesday. You're going to be here tomorrow also. Kim and Paul, how are you?
Good.
Doing all right.
Wow, it was like Donnie and Marie the way you answered that. Who's a little bit country and who's a little bit rock and roll? That's what I want to know.
I call dibs on rock and roll.
All right, then I'm for sure country.
Oh, I love country. I love rock and roll, too.
Actually,
though.
I love them both, too.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Who wants to sing? Okay, maybe not. Anyway, this is Understanding Autism. Such a great show. And, of course, we have in studio all the way from Houston, Texas. You fly in. Paul, you're amazing. Paul Loudon, of course. And Paul is a 28-year-old young man who was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome at age 23. And, of course, you have a heart to help others, and you really have the passion to spread autism awareness to as many people as you can. So I think that's a real credit to you, Paul, to fly all this way to help people, because it is sort of misunderstood, wouldn't you say, Kim?
I would say definitely misunderstood. It also seems like it's Asperger's can be a very hidden-type disability, which we've spoken about on previous shows, but
a good point.
More and more people are being diagnosed at a later age because it's a very complex disorder, and it can be deceiving to the eye sometimes, what you're seeing and what's actually really going on in the brain.
Wow, that's amazing. And of course, we should introduce you, Kimberly Isaac. Wow, that sounds familiar, that last name. Anyway, Kimberly Isaac has worked with people on the autism spectrum for over 14 years. I do remember that, ages 2 to 45 and even older. And, of course, you work with individuals with following therapeutic models, relationship development intervention, RDI, applied behavior analysis, ABA. Sounds like a football league or something. But anyway, they did have the ABA. Remember, Paul?
Okay. I wouldn't know.
I think they did. And, of course, you have your own consulting business that focuses on learning principles of relationship development intervention. And, of course, you offer a full RDI program, and you work and specialize with teens and adults, and that's a little unusual, I think, right? Well, there's a lot of little kids that are on the spectrum. However, you choose to focus on teens and adults.
I do. I adore little children as well, but what I was finding is that it was harder to find professionals who felt comfortable and motivated to work with the older population, and I was highly motivated to go to the need.
Which is so important. Go to the need. I love that. That could be a new slogan. Go to the need. And but that's important because sometimes there are certain sections of the population that are left out, which is sort of sad.
Yes. Yeah, and it really is. And I think that the good news is I think there are more and more professionals that are becoming comfortable working with a variety of age groups, and that's good news.
Well, that is good news. And, of course, we have a continuation pretty much of a topic we had last month, which I found really fascinating, social referencing and why it's important. Why don't you want to do a little summary of what we did last month to get people up to speed in case they missed it? And, of course, if they did miss it, you can always go where? To breakradioshow.com, go to archive shows, pick Understanding Autism, and listen to all these great educational and inspirational shows.
Yes, definitely. You can always visit the archives and at your convenience and check out previous shows. Actually, before we get into the summary, I just had a couple of announcements I wanted to make. I wanted to give a shout-out to the guys at Enterprise Rental Car in the Ahwatukee Foothills. And actually, every Enterprise that I've visited have been just amazing. But these guys are incredibly supportive of small business owners, of my business, supporting the needs that I have in order to serve the families that I serve. And I just really wanted to thank Armin and Nick from the Ahwatukee Foothills location. And also just to, if there are people who have small businesses out there or have businesses that are in helping fields, they are more than willing to help and have just amazing service, are friendly, welcoming, and extremely professional. So I really wanted to thank them. They've helped me and some of my clients a lot.
Wow. I've had good experience, too, with Enterprise.
Yes, they're the best. They
wow.
really are.
That is so cool. And so, that's the one in Tempe, you said?
Nick and Armin are actually in the Ahwatukee Foothills location.
Nice area.
Although I travel frequently in my work, and every location I visited, whether I'm in Houston or the D.C. area, Missouri, anywhere I go, I've had such positive experiences with them, and I just wanted to show some appreciation.
You know, Paul, we think we'll be seeing Kim run through a commercial like an airport, jumping over, we'll call you O.J. Kim. So anyway, remember that commercial, Kurt? Yeah, a commercial with O.J. Simpson. So anyway, that's a nice shout out.
It really is. I really just want to thank them for being so supportive of my business, my Autism with Excellence, and for the excellent service they provide me and my colleagues, coworkers, and clients.
And of course, this week, the 12th Annual Autism Conference, starring Kim. You're going to be speaking there, right?
Well, it's not starring me, but thank you for the shout out.
You're like Enterprise. I'm giving you a shout out.
No, this week, Friday and Saturday, is the 12th Annual Autism Conference presented by the Autism Society of America, the Phoenix chapter. And it's a wonderful conference. There's going to be some excellent speakers. And I believe there is still time to register. If you want to go to the website, www.phxautism.org, you can find out more information, or you can call 480-831-2047. And yes, I will be speaking on Saturday in one of the breakout sessions.
And what's your topic?
Social referencing.
I love it. Look at that. The preview of Saturday's action.
So you're all getting a head start.
And this is going to be where? In Scottsdale somewhere, right?
Yes. Actually, this year they're having it at Scottsdale Bible Church.
Oh,
in the
nice.
Past, it's been at various venues, ASU Main Campus, ASU West. And this year it's being held at Scottsdale Bible Church. But I definitely encourage people who are interested to check it out. And there is still time to sign up.
That is so cool. That's very valuable and probably a great resource for a lot of people.
Yes, there's going to be a variety of topics, everything from different interventions, sensory occupational therapy-based discussions, behavioral discussions, support in utilizing funding. The Arizona Department of Developmental Disabilities is going to have a question and answer portion. So I just encourage people to go to the site and check it out and hope to see you there.
And are they going to have music therapy there?
Actually, they will.
Is it our friend? Actually,
it's not going to be Mr. Rich. We will miss him. It's actually another music therapist, but they are going to have a breakout session to go through and explain and share some samples about what music therapy is all about.
Oh, that's fantastic stuff. I was really engaged in that last month. So tell us, social referencing and why it's important,
yes.
And a little summary from last month.
Yes. Well, this month's topic is an extension of what we discussed last month, which was social referencing and why it's important. And in summary of last month's show, social referencing means it refers to the developmental process that occurs when children from a very young age, actually 3 to 4 months of age, begin to look to a primary reference point to gain information about the world around them.
And what would a primary reference point mean?
A parent, a caregiver, even a sibling, people that are close to the child. And social referencing occurs. It's actually a critical piece of development for many reasons. One being, it helps the child learn to make sense of the world. It's a way to clarify things that are uncertain. So, for example, if you have a young child who's playing maybe with their toys on the floor and hears a noise, you know, they don't know where it's coming from. An example of social referencing would be to look to mom, like the look of, what's that? And mom making an expression to help clarify. Like maybe mom would make a surprised face, like, I don't know, but I heard it too. You know, all of this is done nonverbally. because obviously infants don't have the language yet. But the using observation to help decode some situations around them is what helps them learn to categorize and make sense of certain situations around them. And it's a very important developmental milestone that people with autism don't always get to experience fully.
So that's very important, like you said, in development. And that's something that you can, is that like an intervention is what you're saying? That once you know that social referencing is very important as a therapist, as a facilitator, is this something you work on a lot?
Well, definitely. First, a developmental assessment of some sort would be done, obviously, because this is not necessarily the starting point. But social referencing is a core deficit of autism, and so that is something we would include in a person's treatment program in order to help them learn to use emotional social feedback to help them make sense of certain things that are going on around them or just within the interactions to understand and clarify intent.
So let's ask Paul then. Social referencing is, so this is something that perhaps in your early years you weren't able to develop. Is that right?
That's really hard to answer because, I look back at it and it's hard to see what I wasn't doing. I mean, you know, there are a million things you aren't doing at any given point in time. And so, you know, I look back there and I know I missed a lot of stuff. It's hard for me to realize what I missed because when I look back, I can't see the things that I didn't see.
Yeah, well, that makes sense. But once you see, I guess there's some tools and techniques and things that you can learn to notice, which helps in social referencing. Is that right, Kim?
Well, one of the first things is being aware that it's something of value.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people on the spectrum, because they're very comfortable with language-based communication alone, because it's concrete. Supposed to be concrete. I mean, it sort of is concrete. But when people add their own tone and emotion to it, it can change the meaning. And that's something that can be very confusing for a person on the spectrum. So once you realize there's more to look for within interactions, that awareness alone kind of takes you in a different direction and creates another self-awareness.
So that's interesting. So you, like you said, it was nonverbal, so it's not just what someone says, but how they say it is
right.
Something that you want to be aware of. And then you have to attach meaning to it.
Right. But specifically with social referencing, taking it way back just developmentally, because this is something, well, yes, it's a core deficit of autism spectrum disorders. It's actually just a typical developmental milestone that doesn't fully get developed. For many people with autism, because it is really hard to tell what a person with autism is receiving within an interaction and what they're not. It's almost like two people are processing different aspects of what seems like it would be the same conversation or interaction. And I know Paul and I have talked a little bit about this sort of concept too. When one person's focused on one thing and you don't realize it because it's an internal process they're experiencing and not able maybe to take the perspective of the other partner, a lot of confusion can occur.
So that's got to be a great skill too, learning how to take the other person's perception.
Well, and social referencing teaches that over time.
That is incredibly valuable, actually, for anyone really, whether you're on the spectrum or
well,
not.
Definitely.
Yeah, there's no doubt. So how does it relate to motivation then?
Good question. Well, because in development, and this starts again, I want you to think development, so going back to younger children, because that's where it starts, is they learn over time that they can gain information about the world around them, the meaning of interactions and communications, and get that additional perspective by observing more experienced partners, whether it's a parent or a caregiver or a sibling. And that actually really adds to connections they make about their own actions or inactions and behaviors. And an example is sometimes you could probably picture this in your mind, but if you have a younger child maybe who just did an art project at school or something, and they show it to mom or dad, they're going to hold it up and they're going to be watching for the reaction of the parent, because that information is going to tell them, did I do good? Did I not do good? Some of those things are extremely important in leading to motivation in terms of self-identity and also just reinforcing concepts. I did do good, helping someone measure their performance level. Sometimes that's hard to measure. And sometimes you might have a kid who thinks it's really bad and won't even show the parents, but the parents see it and have this amazing reaction, and the child's like, wow, I guess I did do okay. But if you're unable to take some of those feedbacks and integrate them usefully, you lose some of that perspective. And that leads to motivation, because everybody has the need to be competent and feel confident about what they're doing and how they're interacting with people. And if you're missing certain information, it makes it hard to want to put yourself in situations where lots of uncertainty can occur.
So what's interesting is that, and I guess I'll make a statement, and it might be a form of a question in a way, the parents, knowing how important this is in a sort of in the social referencing and skill development department and creating meaning, it's good for parents, I suspect, to really understand this. So if they're giving off bad feedback, it could do the opposite effect. It could really hurt someone's self-esteem, I suspect.
Well, that's definitely true. I think in the case of autism, it's just lots of misunderstandings. I know that Paul's given examples of misunderstandings that he's encountered where, one person just assumes that you're able to take in what they're thinking and their own meaning that they're giving. But a person with autism is just looking at one component. And so a lot of tension can be created and miscommunication and misunderstanding of each other.
So as part of the consulting and therapy is teaching the parent that awareness too, that they have nonverbal communication going on that they need to understand and watch the child or someone on the spectrum to see what responses they're getting?
Well, it's all about awareness. So it's either about teaching the parent or teaching a guide. In the case of working with the older population, a lot of times I serve as a guide. It's just being aware that the communication that I'm giving, I need to be watching for certain responses or non-responses and making sure that I understand what my client is thinking. I don't want to just assume. I want to ask questions and help clarify my point of view as well, so that we can get down to a point of clarity and understand each other better as a starting point. And so that's how, in terms of social referencing, understanding each other is one of the first steps. So education about what it is, why it's important, and how to monitor your own communication is really important.
And also, what do you watch for?
Right.
What do you watch for?
Well, I watch for nonverbal feedback or verbal feedback that I might get that I realize, oh, I actually meant something different. And the verbal feedback I'm getting kind of shows me that maybe somebody thought this. So I may need to clarify or investigate further.
So the meaning of communication is the response you get?
Partially.
Okay. He thought you were waiting for me to do an NLP presupposition, and I did.
Well, I mean, I knew that was coming at some point. It came last time. It's true that from one perspective, the meaning of communication is the response that you get. But it can be very hard, for me at least, to exist in communication like that continually. Because for a lot of people, it's possible to a degree to predict the response you're going to get, because a lot of us sort of have the same sort of – you go into any conversation with a whole stack of assumptions, and at least a decent portion of them are likely to be true for someone who's not on the spectrum, that certain words are going to have an emotional tint to them. If you use – if you say, I don't like this, it's going to mean the same as I dislike this. You know, where those are actually two technically different statements. I don't like blue shoes does not necessarily mean I dislike blue shoes. It just does means that I'm not liking blue shoes. And there's a space in between where I'm neutral about them. You know, so for someone who's thinking very technically, statements like that might not mean the same as they do to the people around them. And so you're going to be getting responses that you don't understand and giving responses that they don't understand. So the meaning of a conversation is the response you get works as long as there's a shared set of assumptions that both sides can work from. But as soon as you lose those assumptions, it starts becoming a lot more difficult to have a predictable series of responses. And once you lose the ability to predict the responses, the information content of the communications just sort of starts breaking down.
And this is a really important point, because what happens is that I think people, for no intentional reason, forget that this kind of development is a process. So it's easy, and I think for especially working with teens and adults, one of the reasons it seems like it is such this hidden disability is when you meet somebody who can speak so clearly and has a high IQ and looks, you know, like yourself, just like an average regular person, it's hard to remember that the mental processes they developed may not have been the same that you developed. And so somebody may engage a person on the spectrum in such a way where they assume those things are there, and a lot of potential friction can occur.
Well, speaking of potential friction, this is something that happened to me very recently, is that someone had an emotional reaction to a news article that I didn't quite understand. And my choice of asking them about, you know, why did it cause this reaction to you? Why were you shocked by this? Or why did you express shock about this? To them was perceived as criticism, because I was asking them, why are you doing this? And they saw that as a very negative statement. The conversation occurred entirely in text, so there wasn't a tone of voice to express that I was just genuinely curious. And so they accused me of going on a monologue criticizing them about it because I was asking them to try to understand their things, and accused me of lying about my intent because they weren't able to put themselves in a position where they would genuinely be asking about such a thing. Their perception was, if I were saying these kinds of things, it would have this intent, so he must have this intent. And that's one of those unspoken assumptions that happens a lot, is that people assume that you're going to work in a very similar way.
Right. And social referencing, I mean, kind of moving into helping make connections for listeners about this, is it's all about the emotional feedback system. And that's why in development, when you go back and you look, it really starts that young to where, you know, in fact, young to where you have like an infant. You look at, you're gazing at them. You might be smiling. The baby smiles back and gives you a feedback. Well, what happens if the baby doesn't smile back? It feels kind of weird innately. When you know something's kind of supposed to happen and it's not, you start behaving differently. And when you understand the importance of how that's where the feedback system starts, is at those kinds of moments. But from there, it evolves into looking to your parents for information when you're uncertain. You know, last show, I think we used the example of, you know, you've seen kids on the playground, maybe they fall down and they're not really sure if they're okay, but they look to mom, and mom will either go, you're fine, and they'll calm down, or mom will get hysterical and the kid will start to cry. Why is that? He's looking to his mom for information about how to categorize what has just happened to him. And that feedback system is critical, and a lot of times gets lost inadvertently in the feedback system with people who have autism spectrum disorders and their parents, because nobody really understands how that works. But once you understand it, you can start doing things to help restore it.
Now, can you teach some techniques and tools to really young kids to develop more awareness, or is there sort of a starting age?
Well, I mean, it's not really teaching to the young kids, is it, so much as creating a situation that leads them to it, where you're helping to build an environment where it's easy for them to develop these tools themselves. If you create if you try to just create behaviors, that's all they are a learned behavior. But if it's something that they are better able to develop internally, this is something I've noticed especially in my own life, is the things that I sort of found a way to develop myself naturally, I want to say, as opposed to cognitively, they work better.
Well, and that's really the truth, is because in development we call it guided participation. I mean, the parent has more life experience than the child. So the parent or the guide is the person whose primary job would be to not only just understand development and these particular deficits, but understand how to create opportunities for it to naturally occur. Because we always want to strive for teaching people on the spectrum in the most natural way we can. Otherwise, we're not really doing them as much of a service. If we're teaching them in unnatural ways, how is that helping them to integrate and understand how we're interacting? It really doesn't. So it's important that a person has a guide, whether it's a trained guide, a parent, a sibling, somebody that is willing to go through a process of education and learning to look for opportunities to create those moments to occur.
So the parents and or the guide becomes a critical component,
yes,
of this guided participation.
Yes.
And what happens if parents don't cooperate? It becomes really difficult, right?
It would. It would. I mean, generally, I wouldn't say I've ever had parents that don't cooperate as much as it was maybe a process too overwhelming for them, and they either A, just needed some more time in the education realm to understand core deficits even, or maybe I've had some families that just needed to go through personal therapy before they were able to be present for their kids. There's nothing wrong with any of that. Everybody is where they are, and we want to work with everybody where they are, whether it's the parent, the guide, or the affected person. We want to meet them where they're at and gradually move them forward.
You know, and it was interesting that you gave the example of like a little infant where you smile and those infants smile back. And if they don't, you know, I suspect that can create different beliefs within the parent, which mm-hmm. could have different communication. You said it changed behaviors, but yes, just saying having different beliefs about the lack of response certainly can create another communication that won't do the child any good.
Well, definitely. One more thing I want to add about that example is, as it relates to motivation, is when that exchange starts to occur, and if the listeners can sort of hold that picture in their minds for a second, you have this exchange with a child, and eventually what happens is, okay, so I smile, baby smiles, I smile back, and then my smile's even bigger because it feels
right,
good.
Right.
So there's actually some emotional payoff that's starting even at that young age to where when I do this, mom smiles even bigger. Oh, I wonder what else is going to impact her emotionally. And that's a small piece of where motivation begins to develop, as you realize you have an impact on other people's emotions.
You know, that's huge, and it's a great
learning. And vice versa.
Yes. Yeah, it seemed like it'd be a great learning for both the child and the parent. And when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Kim Isaac and Paul Loudon. This is Understanding Autism, the topic social referencing. Very important and a great benefit, and there's no question for both the parent, the guide, the child, probably the whole family unit and anyone that's related there. And we'll be right back.
Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a multi-practice law firm, ideally equipped to assist with a broad range of legal and business issues, corporate and financial transactions, real estate, commercial, litigation, bankruptcy, and private client practice. Weidenauer, Heinten & Lewis is a law firm that bases its practice on understanding the businesses of their clients, and they use this insight to meet each client's unique and evolving legal challenges. Call or click today, 602-254-9900. Find them on the web at rhkl-law.com.
Do you owe money to the IRS? Have you heard of possible payment options such as a partial payment installment agreement? offering compromise or not currently collectible status. Knowing that you have options and what those options are will greatly relieve your worry and stress. Hi, my name is Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor. If you are curious as to what options may be available to you if you owe money to the IRS, my 25 years experience as a CPA may very well help you in these times of uncertainty. Stop worrying and start learning about what options you have. If you just want to talk to someone about your IRS debt or want specific advice, I invite you to call me at 602-625-3074. That is 602-625-3074. And when you call, ask for me, Dave Isaac, CPA and former government tax auditor.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism, starring Tim Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas. And I got to get out there and get some barbecue ribs. Anyway, I just thought I'd throw that in. We're talking about social referencing. And Kim, you wanted to elaborate a little bit more on that and get into some motivation concepts.
Well, I know, because I get a little excited about topics and actually, I'm trying to perspective take myself even as I do this, because I realize that a lot of listeners, it may be a little bit difficult to understand. So I kind of want to give one more sort of clearer picture so that it makes sense as we go into some of the motivation stuff. But one of the reasons it's so important to restore that natural feedback system is because if you think about all the thousands of hours that infants and small children spend observing, that's when they're learning what is important to them based on not only what they've experienced, but the feedback they've gotten. And so if that piece isn't in place, it makes it very hard to make connections on where they sort of fit in to the world, perhaps, and also not having that emotional feedback. Emotional feedback is also highly motivating. And that example with the baby smiling back, and it actually increases your smile. When you learn that you can have an effect on other people's emotions through your behavior or even just a smile, that actually intrinsically makes connections in the brain that lead to motivation. So sometimes you hear about people maybe, you know, some people, everyone has a different internal motivation, but some people you think, okay, they want to make their parents proud. Maybe that's a very strong thing for them. Well, okay, so it could be that over time they've had a lot of feedback back and forth where they've noticed, wow, when I do this, I get a really strong feedback from my parent, and it feels good to me. So it's encoding not only what you're experiencing in a circumstance, but how you're encoding interactions and what the feedback means to you that are supposed to actually connect and integrate in order to help develop the internal motivation. And for people on the spectrum, and that actually portion right there is something that involves episodic memory. And we build episodic memory through social referencing because we begin to encode how we feel about things with the actual things themselves. And it's a lot of processing going on. And it's hard for people on the spectrum to hold all of those things in their mind sometimes.
But it's interesting. You said it really helps to develop what's important to people, and that's part of motivation itself, because if you don't know what's important to you, how do you become motivated to do? Usually you're motivated when you know what's important and you have that as a high value.
Right. And so while people on their own can certainly find things that they value and that are important to them, the added social feedback that they get within these interactions provides another dimension of emotional connection to why they do what they do. And that's a big breakdown in the motivation cycle, one of the breakdowns in the motivation cycle, sometimes for people on the spectrum.
And so you, how do you diagnose something like that? I mean, I think you said that in the beginning you have to do, or I guess an assessment you said, and is that easy to pick up? Or is that a long process?
Easy for a trained professional.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Definitely not easy if you don't know what you're looking for, or if you're looking at behavior alone and not analyzing the processes behind the behavior.
Very tough, right?
And if you're not examining typical development, I mean, something in autism I think that I would like to see improve is that people actually look at development and do their best to teach in a developmental manner versus in an alternate manner. Because basically, some of these interventions are actually teaching people, and they think they're teaching social referencing, but they're doing it in a behavioral way, and the processes aren't developing the way that they're supposed to developmentally.
I think Paul was talking about that. Just behaviors alone just won't cut it.
Yeah, I mean, from my perspective, it's like building a shell and expecting the inside to fill itself in versus building the core and letting it build up outwards. I mean, just in a very loose perspective, that think about how you can teach science in school. There's two generalized ways you can teach science. You can tell people, this is what happens, this is what happens, this is what happens. Tell them all the theories up to where we are. Just let them read from the book. Or you can show them a melting ice cube and say, so now, kids, why is this ice cube melting? And they'll say, well, maybe it's because we're all looking at it. Okay, let's stop looking at it. No, it's still melted. Maybe it's because it's hot in here. Let's put it somewhere cold and see if it stops melting. You can let them experiment and learn. Create a situation in which their curiosity guides them to the outcome you want rather than just telling them what that outcome is. And it creates a different way of learning because the child develops his own understanding of what's going on rather than just taking it on faith and following a set of rules.
And, Kim, you talked about that. I guess Paul's describing guided participation. That is really what you're talking
yes.
about. And setting up an environment, you're impressed that I'm actually learning this. Okay. Now, the other thing is, here's what I'm going to suggest.
We call it actually experience-based learning versus instructional learning. Now, we do need instructional learning, so I don't want anybody to misunderstand. I mean, obviously, that has a value and a place. But when we're teaching social-emotional development, it has to be experiential-based in order for a person to actually gain the perspectives they need to gain through actual experience with whatever's going on around them and the feedback that they're getting about what's going on around them.
And Paul, I like what you said. That was a great example. What came to mind when you were giving that example is like you can actually discuss or describe how to ride a bike, or you can put someone on the bike. Isn't that similar?
And some people, from hearing how to ride it, can get on a bike and just do it the first time. Other people will hear how to ride it, get the wrong picture in their head, get on it, and do it completely wrong, and you may have to teach them even more to get them set straight again. That sometimes hearing about something can actually be harmful towards mm-hmm. what you're actually getting to if you aren't experiencing it while you're hearing about it, if you aren't developing an understanding of it rather than just a knowledge of it.
So that really becomes really important, I would say, in the educational system for teachers to learn a new way of teaching.
Yeah, or just expand on how they're teaching. I mean, some things in the school system are appropriate to be taught instructionally, but not everything. And I think there's a huge assumption made for people that are on the spectrum that are in the school systems, it's assumed that these emotional processes have been developed. So they're instructing, but there's a whole thing that's missing that is unseen. And again, I don't want to, it's not intentional on the part of the teacher, but this is a very complex disorder. And if you don't understand that, you can't go by behavior alone. It doesn't matter how many skills a person has. Social emotional development requires experience-based learning. It's a process. It requires one-to-one attention over time.
Well, I mean, in education or in any communication, really, there's three main channels of communication. There's explicit verbal communication, what you say. There's explicit nonverbal communication, how you say it, but there's still things that you have expressed, such as body language showing you're angry. And then there's implicit nonverbal communication, which is the things that you neither say nor show, but still expect them to pick up just by assumptions that are shared between you. Cultural references, for example. You may not say something, but because everyone in the culture knows about McDonald's, when you mention the Golden Arches, they know you mean McDonald's. And so there's shared language in, you know, the words, there's shared language in the body language, and then there's shared culture where you don't have to say anything. And one of those channels, the nonverbal one, is often the one that's missing in someone who's on the spectrum. And the nonverbal one is a large part of how we communicate that third channel, the shared assumptions. So they may be missing two channels. So when you think about it, think about Mad Libs. You fill in those words, and then you see how they fit in the sentence. And, you know, someone might only have a few blanks because they are only trying to guess a few of the implied assumptions. And someone on the spectrum may have a whole lot more blanks. And the more blanks you've got, the further from any specific meaning you end up. And that's sort of how I see it from my perspective, is that if you're missing both of these channels and you're just working on, you know, explicit communications of one form or another, then you've got a problem. If someone teaches you to look for the nonverbal, you get that second, that explicit nonverbal. But you still aren't necessarily picking up the shared assumptions because you don't have a framework in place for internalizing those things, for keeping them with you. And so you only really have the tools to look for the explicit things.
I think that's really interesting, especially that third one. I really liked what you just said, is that shared assumptions are the implicit that's not said or not seen. And then I think, Paul, you were telling us a little bit off there that what you like to do is really ask. I don't know how you do it, but you're probably asking, like, out of curiosity, I wonder what they assume that's not showing up.
Well, yeah, that's one thing I find myself having to do anytime I'm communicating with people. And this is part of why I'm more comfortable around people I know well, is because I've picked up on what some of their assumptions are likely to be. Is that when I'm talking with someone, I have to sit there and think, you know, what can I infer about this person's background or beliefs or what they've said so that I can sort of guess what they're assuming I will already know.
That totally makes sense. And then sometimes we're our own worst enemy, too. And what are we assuming that it's so unconscious that we're just communicating based on these assumptions? And had you changed your own assumptions, you might behave differently.
Well, if you look at any statement someone makes, there's always room to make assumptions about it and then change the meaning of that same statement into any of a dozen things. So, I mean, you know, I know I'm as guilty of it as anyone else is going into a conversation with assumptions, and that makes it very difficult.
Well, I think one thing that's important to add, too, is because this is a developmental process, and especially when you have someone who has such a high skill set in one area and maybe missed out on some of these earlier processes, it's a lot more active on the part of the affected person to constantly have to be asking and engaging, and I would imagine it would be very, very tiring to do that. With younger kids or even kids actually in some ways teaching this social, emotional, developmental stuff, it's actually better if they have less skills. The skills get in the way actually sometimes. But as we're talking about this, I'm realizing too, it is so important for people to understand the self-awareness that's involved, whether you're the affected person or the person who's the guide, on how you're communicating and the feedback you're getting. I mean, sometimes even, like, as I'm even talking with the two of you here on the show, I might be saying something. I'm watching to see how much you understand. Now, yes, this is a verbal situation we have, but if you're shaking your head yes, if you're nodding, that gives me a nonverbal that's saying, I'm sort of with you. That's another example of the feedback system in a way that I'm hoping listeners can relate to in a different way. But if you're giving me the look, you know, the twinge and the squinty eye look, like, I don't know about this, I think, you know, maybe I need to rearrange my agenda a little bit here because I think this is a really important topic.
And see, there you had the nod is an explicit nonverbal, but the meaning of the nod is an implicit one. We usually don't teach people what nodding means. It's something that you pick up. You see someone nodding while they say yes, and it implies to you that the nod is a positive statement.
Right.
There's a lot of cultures where shaking your head is yes and nodding your head is no. And that could cause pretty significant understandings if you don't realize that there's that difference. You learn the language, but you don't learn their body language. And they have similar actions that mean different things. It's like the difference between forward V and backwards V in England, that one of them is very, very rude. And so,
okay.
You know, there's body language that you wouldn't necessarily assume has a meaning that's different from your own until someone explicitly tells you it, and you carry those shared assumptions around with you.
And when we come back from our break, we'll continue our discussion with Kim Isaac and Paul Alden. This is Understanding Autism, Most incredible concept, the social referencing. And Paul, I like what you said. I want to go over that a little bit more, the explicit verbal and the shared assumption. Very important. We'll be right back.
Are you able to ensure the safe driving and productivity of your employees? I'm Kara Lee with GPS Heroes, and with our plug-and-play GPS device, you can set geofences, get speeding alerts, and a full report card each week with driver reports and mileage, all to your computer or handheld device. It's easy to get and easy to use, in real time, with no service contracts. Just go to gpsheroes.org/21 and order yours today. That's gpsheroes.org/21.
Is it important for you to develop a financial plan without the potential conflict associated with commission sales? As a fee-only financial planner, I am paid by you and only you, my client. I'm not compensated in any way by the recommendations I provide. Have you heard the phrase, people do not plan to fail, they fail to plan? My experience has shown that this is too often true when considering one's financial future. If you're ready to take action, call me, Bob Berger, Certified Financial Planner and Certified Divorce Financial Analyst, directly at 602-235-0336. We'll discuss your financial situation and review some small or perhaps large changes that will help you obtain the financial future you desire. Don't let the lack of a plan affect your family's financial future. Call me, Bob Berger, at 602-235-0336 for a free consultation. Again, Bob Berger, Certified Financial Planner, 602-235-0336.
And welcome back again. You're listening to Breakthrough Thinking with Dave Isaac. This is Understanding Autism with Kim Isaac and Paul Loudon, all the way from Houston, Texas. And we're talking about a very, very important subject, social referencing, a skill. And it's probably really beyond a skill. I mean, it's something that people...
It's a mental process.
Yeah, it's an important one to function effectively, let's say, in life.
It is. And as we're sitting here doing the show, I realize... I get really excited about these concepts, and I feel like we're going to bring in the motivation aspect. I know we told everybody we were going to get to that today, but I really feel like where we're going with the social referencing is important. So I want to just send this little disclaimer out. We're going to bring motivation into the mix, but I want to continue really painting these clear pictures for the listeners about what social referencing is, how to think about it. Because without that, things that I want to share about motivation may not make as much sense, and I want to make sure the listeners are getting as much out of this topic as possible.
So how do you think about it? How do you think about social referencing then?
Well, I want to be as clear as I can, and the best ways I can articulate it is that the emotional feedback system is what's developed through social referencing. And without that emotional feedback system, and what I mean by that is the observation of how we're impacting each other emotionally, how am I assuming, how are you assuming, all of these things we've talked about on the show are all related. What's important to realize is that in development, people take the social feedback that they're getting and they integrate it and put it in part of their database of personal meaning, of how to make sense of the world around them. And if you can imagine a person who's not understanding social feedback, or the partners are just confused with each other, a lot of these misunderstandings can lead to categorizing things about people or themselves that really aren't maybe as accurate as they could be with the right social information being inputted.
Well, like I was talking about the three levels of the explicit verbal, the explicit nonverbal, and the implicit. Is the explicit nonverbal tells you something when you're having a conversation with someone and you see they get tense or they have an upset look at your face. It tells you that's an explicit communication that they're upset, and so you've got the explicit nonverbal, and that's something you can teach someone to look for. And then beyond that, it shares something about them. If you watch the explicit nonverbal responses of someone, it shows you where your assumptions are matching theirs and where your assumptions aren't. And so that actually gives you a sort of clue into what their assumptions are about the situation. And that's something that sort of goes beyond it. It's like, what is the explicit nonverbal? And then why is the explicit nonverbal? And it's sort of coming to that second question that's a very important step.
And a lot of developmental pieces sort of stem from this, too. You think about how and a key point to social referencing, too, is in moments of uncertainty. Because remember, in development, babies don't know what they're doing. You know, at first, they don't even know what their hands are. They don't have language. They don't have skills. Their primary job as infants is to observe the world around them and observe how they're impacting others and how others are behaving with each other. Now, a person on the spectrum, for reasons unknown, their brains don't gravitate towards that kind of observation. Like sometimes you'll see in development people on the spectrum, they may be observing the exit sign by the door instead of watching the interaction. And if you think about the impact of that, if where you're spending your observation time is on things that aren't related to social feedback and learning about the feedback system, you actually construct beliefs and self-identity based on not the full information. And so we want to, I really would like to help listeners understand the importance of relational-based and experience-based learning, because we want to teach children or students to learn from our eyes. We want to teach them to learn through the eyes of their parents. If they're not able to understand what the perspective and the eyes of their parents are, they're going to miss out on a lot of important social emotional information. So it's important to recognize that not only is it important to learn how to categorize and integrate personal meaning and social meaning, it's also important because it helps add to your sense of self-identity and self-concept, which is sort of the bridge that I'll take in another show that leads into the motivation aspect. But if listeners today could leave with just a couple of thoughts, is holding those pictures in your mind of how important the emotional feedback system is, and how social referencing plays into that.
That's got to be huge, and especially you were mentioning self-identity, which probably relates somehow to self-esteem issues, too, at an identity level. And that, from there, can form all sorts of beliefs, like you said, and some empowering, some disempowering. And that would be a tough situation, challenging to function in the world if you have disempowering beliefs, which leads to behaviors that really don't work in the world.
That's definitely true. I mean, I think there's a lot of factors to this topic, but I think what's important for the autism community to remember is not to discount the relationship aspect of the work with your child, because there are a lot of therapies out there that are so we need to get them to do skills, and no matter how many skills you have, that is not going to replace a typical developmental process that all humans are wired to go through. And people with autism just need the pace altered and the information spotlighted, and they can learn it.
Oh, that's a good way.
I mean, it's kind of the difference between the give a man a fish, teach a man a fish thing. You know, you give someone a skill, or you teach them the ability to develop their own skills as the situation changes. You know, with one of them, they're okay in one situation. With another, they, you know, might not immediately show changes as quickly, but they will have a toolbox that is possibly better able to deal with upcoming situations as the world around them changes.
So when you talk about skills, are you really talking about when you teach skills, you're really doing behavior modification only? Is that the same?
Yes. I mean, it's a fundamental difference between a therapy such as ABA and RDI. Is ABA focuses on manipulation of the environment and controlling environmental situations to teach certain behaviors. And RDI focuses on reinstating this typical developmental process where we create opportunities for observation, social referencing, those things to occur in order for the mental processes to lead to the behavior. So, and I think that's a really critical difference, because there's just because a part of the brain is a little bit weaker maybe than others, and what you can compare it to is if you're teaching skills, you're actually teaching to a part of the brain for people with autism that's actually already strong. Most people can learn skills. The parts of the brain where skills are developed for people with autism are already strong. The parts of the brain where developing the mental processes is actually weaker. So I get confused as to why we would teach to the strong part versus the weak part.
And that is our notice that this hour has flown by. Can you believe that?
Wow.
Was that
quick? No, I can't.
Who do we got tomorrow?
Well, we have an amazing group from Houston, Texas. Archer Consulting is going to inspire us on how to be proactive about future planning. And also, we encourage people to go to our Facebook page, facebook.com/understandingautismradio. And also, you can email us at autismwithexcellence.com.
Well, thank you, Kim Isaac. Thank you, Paul Loudon. I'll see you tomorrow, 3 to 4, and with these great guests. And thank you for such an important topic, very valuable. And hopefully the listeners will take this to heart, and we'll give out the contact information tomorrow.
Definitely.
We're out of time, and we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.